You're listening to episode 15 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, and in this show I talk about Linux and Unix and BSD and all kinds of technical and complex and interesting things, sometimes more complex than other times. In this episode, which is late, yes, if you have noticed, it is actually about a week late now. I have an excuse, though. I was at the Northeast Linux Fest. In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of old-school Unix-y topics, some web server comparisons that I've been doing, nothing with numbers and charts or anything, but just kind of impressions, and, of course, listener feedback and probably some other topics. So let's start out with listener feedback, as usual. So the first listener feedback I got, according to my mailbox here, is from 330. I don't know if this is actually feedback for my show, but he sent me a joke, and I thought it was pretty funny, so I'm going to tell it. And if I'm feeling particularly confident and good in my stand-up skills, I will insert a laugh track so that you know when to laugh. So why does the anarchist only drink herbal tea? Give up? Because property is theft. I thought that was pretty funny. Okay, next email is Doug. Doug has written the show a couple of times. You might recognize him, if not by name, then by topic, and the topic that he's usually writing me about is Python. And he's often telling me that I should learn more about Python and get better at Python and all these other things. And he actually has two points that I want to address in his feedback this time around. And I'll address the second point, which is actually dependent upon the first, but I'm going to address that first because the answer is quicker. So Doug says that I should learn Python, and that the reason that I am not doing more Python is because I have not yet been able to find things that I can do in Python that I cannot do in Bash. Fair enough, and makes sense, right? And this is part of his point on the larger scale of things, but I'm like I say, I'm addressing it first because it's easier. It's a good point, and to address that and to kind of to force myself into more Python, I've decided to find a project that I just can't do in a shell script. And one of those is a game, a video game idea, and the other is a front end for UDisk. Now, UDisk, or UDisks, I forget if it's plural or singular, UDisks is the command line front end, or I guess access point for the UDEV sort of disk infrastructure, device infrastructure. So you can list disks that are connected to your machine and that are obviously detected by UDEV through this UDisks thing. You can make partitions, you can format, make file systems, all kinds of fancy kind of disk-related operations that you and I would normally do with FDisk or CFDisk or parted or something like that. So I was thinking that it could use a GUI front end. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Klaatu, it already has a GUI front end called Disks, I think is what it's called. It's a GNOME utility. I've actually only seen it on Fedora, I think, but I have seen mention of it on the GNOME site, so it does exist. It's a GNOME project, as far as I know. It is Python, but it's PyGTK, and right now, PyGTK, for a distribution that doesn't really ship with a whole lot of GNOME parts, is actually, at least Disks, this application, it has a lot of dependencies that are very GNOME-centric. And it's not impossible to install, but it's kind of a bother. Since it's not a must-have application for me, I've never really bothered. But I think it might be kind of neat to have a less GTK-centric, maybe very, very generic, like WXPython, or possibly just not GTK, like PyQt, where it would be, in theory, more portable, more easily ported than PyGTK-based application. So that's what I was kind of thinking for a project, like a front end for UDisk, but in PyQt or Python in general with WXPython or some such widget set as that. So those are my ideas. That's what I'm going to be working on in terms of Python. So Doug, you've won. I'm getting serious. Maybe. So his first point, a little bit wider scale, not just about me learning Python, but a larger kind of broader feedback that he had was that he was enjoying the topic about teaching programming, and because he's taught programming quite a few times. He's had a lot of classes on programming where he's been the instructor. He agrees with what I'm saying, I guess, but he thinks that, quote, another important aspect of learning programming is to seriously consider why. It's important to ask why, to have the student ask why they want to learn programming. I've asked this of my students and gotten interesting answers. I want to build 3D games, and things like, I'd like to automatically update a data file. My real point is that the why is important. If someone can make a computer do everything they want without programming, then clearly they should. A computer is a tool, and if you can get that tool to do what you want, then you win. Programming is hard to learn, and asking why can help someone enough to warrant learning to code, or if some other tools would suffice. I say this not to discourage anyone from learning to program. I think it's a very rewarding endeavor, but it's not easy, and it certainly is ill-suited to someone who just wants to knock something together to get something done. I'm sure carpenters feel the same way about weekend wood butchers. That's the end of his quote. I think that's a really great point. And I have to say, I don't believe that I meant programming fluency. I think I meant more... I don't actually remember what I was talking about, but I'm saying now, even if I have to revise history to make it work, but I think what I was really meaning was that people need to be fluent, have fluency with the idea of the computational process. And I think that doesn't have to be programming. You know, you don't have to know a new language. You don't even have to really, I think you don't even have to get into the command line to really understand how computers work, how they function, the concept behind even how programs run. Because I think it's very important to at least know that when you open up a program, a lot of your data is sitting in RAM now. And if you've got like this 3 gigabyte file and you've got 1 gig of RAM, that would be why your computer is starting to run a little bit slower when you open that thing up. You know, simple things like that that sound really obvious to you and me really do elude the normal computer user. So I think that's the important part of what I would call fluency in how computers work, because so many people just, all they know is that computers are magical, and that's how it all works. And when it doesn't work, it is completely out of their control, like completely out of control. And I keep using the automobile example because for myself, I'm exactly guilty of that kind of blissful stupidity as I think a lot of people are with computers. I mean, there's just, if a car stops working, I know almost nothing about how to fix it, which I'm not really proud of, but apparently I'm okay with enough to not ever teach myself how to do automotive repair. And I agree with Doug in terms of the programming side of things, because I think he's right. Not everyone needs to learn how to program. And I think that a lot of the sites nowadays that are like, you know, Code Academy, teach yourself to code, do this, do that, code, code, code. I mean, those are great because they need to be out there, they need to be available, and they make coding very, very accessible, which I think is really, really important. And I mean, that's what sets apart, like, you know, all the open source programming languages and traditions from things like, you know, that are being sold by the non-open source people. That's what sets it apart, and it's important, but I don't believe everyone necessarily feels like they have to be able to code. That's why technology exists, right? So that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. So if someone does come out with an application that will drive your coffee machine, and that's all you want to do is drag and drop some, yes, turn it on at this point, turn it off at that point, and you're done, great, you didn't have to learn any new technology. You were able to use this interface and it works for you, and you learned that interface, and great. If you at least understand the concepts of what's going on, then you might be able to find a better interface later on, or you might be able to, I don't know, get a free interface from someone or whatever. You know, you've got a little bit more control, a lot more understanding, and when your coffee doesn't turn on at 7 a.m. in the morning, you can start to troubleshoot and figure out why didn't that happen, what's wrong with my workflow or whatever. So that's an interesting point. I think it's really important to figure out why you want to learn to program, if you want to learn to program. Even if you do decide you want to program, you kind of have to know why you're doing it, because otherwise you may be reinventing the wheel, or you might be headed in the wrong direction. So yes, you need to figure out why you want to program before you start, I think. And someone told me that once. I don't remember who it was. It was a long time ago. And they said the best way to learn to program is to have a problem that you want to solve, and then just bang away at that. In an effort to solve that problem, then you have a goal. So that's always a good way too, I think. Not that I know what I'm talking about. So someone else emailed me, Jim. Jim emailed me and said that in the next to last podcast, so I guess that would be 13th episode, I had mentioned a Pentium 4 laptop, I think, that was suitable for use with the current Linux distro, to which he answers, there are Pentium 4s and then there are Pentium 4s. A Pentium 4 1.8 gigahertz laptop will do just fine, whereas a Pentium 4M 1.8 gigahertz will do okay with a in a VM with compiz and wobbly windows. A 4M 1.8 is faster than a 4 2.4 because they left out the hyper-threading, blah, blah, blah. So he goes on basically to say that me saying a Pentium 4 is meaningless, and he's, I'm sure, quite right. I really don't know, because I have to admit I was not following the Pentium 4s very well, or really the Intel CPUs at all, before I got into Linux, because to me at the time they were kind of the enemy, I thought. All I knew was Intel, Windows, it just all kind of seemed one entity to me. I was totally wrong, I realize that. But that's, you know, I really don't have a whole lot of knowledge about CPUs, unfortunately. I've started taking a lot more notice now and feel like I have a much better handle on things, but I'm doing catch-up. So, Pentium 4. The Pentium 4 on my laptop, for the record, is a Pentium dual-core CPU T4200 at 2.0 gigahertz. And then it's got a, I think it's the Mobile 3000 chip, Intel Mobile 3000. So, I, as I probably said, I guess, in the 13th episode of Season 8, I'm fine with this laptop. I really like it. I think it performs quite nicely. But yeah, Pentium 4, I didn't realize they were such a varied CPU. I just saw Pentium 4 and thought it was the equivalent to like a G4 and like a PowerPC G4. So I was quite confused as to how it could possibly be so good. And actually, I think I'd even forgotten up until, like, right now that it was a dual-core CPU. So, yeah, it's doing all right. It's doing fine. Let's see. Next up would be SIG3, who... SIG3, you'll remember from the big debate of elitism and stuff like that. Or not debate, but, like, the conversation of that. Well, he wrote back this time about a neat little bash trick, which I actually kind of already knew. I forget where I saw it. I think I re-saw it on the Linux in the Shell by Dan Washko, and it's just the trick of saying cat redirect to some text file, and then redirect into that text file, quote, EOF, end quote. What this does in your bash session is drop you down to a sort of a homemade text editor. I mean, it's you just start typing. You can hit return as much as you want. It's never going to end that piping of text into this text file until you type the letters EOF and then hit return, and then it sees the EOF, which you had redirected into the text, into that text script, and then it exits and gives you back your prompt. Of course, the EOF does not have to be EOF. It could be anything, but you would want it to be something very unique, because if you typed in anything, then, you know, your name or something, and then you happen to use your name before you actually wanted to close the text file, it would close it prematurely. So EOF, I think, is a pretty good choice. But the point is that, yes, it's a quick and dirty text editor just right there in your bash session. So if you don't want to go into Vim or something, and you don't have Emacs installed or whatever the situation, you can use a quick little text editor right there in Bash. And presumably, I haven't used it all that much, but presumably all of your Bash keyboard shortcuts would apply. So it would almost be, I guess, kind of an Emac like experience, you know, insofar as Control A getting you back to the beginning of the line, Control E. I mean, I haven't tested that, but I'm assuming. So you could try that out if you want to. And I think that's about it for feedback this time around. So we can now continue on to the show, the rest of the show. As I said at the beginning of the show, I am late on this episode because of the Northeast Linux Fest, which I had been meaning to go to, I think, 2 years now. I have not been able to go in 2 years in a row, and finally on this, I believe it was the third Northeast Linux Fest, I was able to make it out there. Me and a friend, Cyanide Cupcake, went out there to hang out at the fest and talk to fellow Hacker Republic Radio hosts and meet new people and kind of do the whole Linux geek thing. And it was a lot of fun, actually. It was really fun. I have to admit, it was a little bit on the expensive side. If you've never been to Boston, Boston is not a cheap town, I have found. But other than that, it was a really, really fun experience. I'd not really been to Boston that much. I'd been there, I guess, a year or two ago for Usenix, but I haven't really felt like I got to explore the city like I was this time around. So that was a lot of fun, just being in a new city and kind of looking around. Beautiful city, very cold, but beautiful. And the festival itself was really, really interesting. It was at Harvard, which is a little university over, well, obviously in Boston, or actually across the river from Boston proper. I think it might be in Cambridge, technically. I'm not really sure. But yeah, it was there. It was fun. It was a great location for it, I guess. I mean, they had a huge display of an old IBM calculator from way back when. It was amazing to look at. I mean, marvelous. I mean, lots of lights and mechanical parts. It was just really, really cool to look at. I mean, it wasn't operating, but just to kind of imagine it back when it was operating, it was really, really cool. And then my friend was going, went downstairs to a snack machine for a drink or something, and noticed that just kind of nestled between two random snack machines was this display case of all this old computer stuff, and it was really cool. She called me down, and I went down there and looked, and it was really cool. There was a PDP manual, an old manual for a PDP. There was a manual for, maybe a VAX. It might have been a VAX handbook. There were, you know, old sticks of RAM and just random old computer stuff. It was really, really cool, and it was hilarious because it was just right there between, like, two snack machines. I kept looking for a slot to put a quarter in and, you know, purchase the PDP manual or something. But that was really, really cool. I also, of course, got to hear Mad Dog talk, which was great. He did a nice talk on, you know, the idea of making money with free software, which obviously is one of those oddly, hotly debated topics, like, well, how could anyone make money on free software? And I think we've all probably heard the answer. I think if you're listening to this show, you probably have a good idea of how free software could be something that you could make money off of, and quite possibly you're one of the people making money off of. I mean, I know that I can honestly say that, you know, the money that I have made in my life so far has been, directly a result of free software. I mean, not because I've been writing it, but because I've been working on supporting it. So there's definitely an argument for that, and he delivered it quite well. I did a talk on Git, which I think went pretty well. A couple of points that I kind of missed, you know, I just kind of forgot to point out, but mostly it went really well, and I'm going to actually give the talk again at a local conference, so I look forward to kind of revising it and doing it all over again. But yeah, Northeast Linux Fest was really, really cool. I got a chance to stop off at MIT as well. That was really great to kind of see that institution, and I went into their museum, the MIT Museum, got to see some robot and some interesting artificial intelligence kinds of machines, including a rack of Lisp machines that was as tall as I was. It was really, really cool. And there was something, I don't remember what it was written in. I think it was called Smart, S-M-A-R-T, and it was some kind of language, I don't know, it was supposed to be an AI, I think, that could decipher, you know, language. And I typed into its little web interface, like, what operating system are you running? And it couldn't tell me. I asked, what programming language were you written in? It couldn't tell me. It really didn't seem to do a whole lot. So finally, I just, I could tell what it was running by the icon set. So I hit Control-Alt-F1, and sure enough, got dropped down to a virtual console, and quickly did a Control-Alt-F6 or 7 or whatever I did, and walked away quickly. But it was fun. I had to walk away quickly because I was the temptation to continue down that path was very strong, and I didn't really want to get kicked out. So, but yeah, MIT Museum, very cool, very fun, lots of interesting technology there. So yeah, the Northeast Linux Fest was a blast. If you have not been, and are in that area, in that general area, then I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. If you want to hear a little bit of what was going on there this year, go over to Hacker Public Radio. They've got some interviews that they're posting, and you can kind of listen in on some of that. But yeah, it was a lot of fun and a great conference. And obviously there was a sort of general awareness of kind of like blind accessible computing because Jonathan Nadeau was kind of in charge of that festival. I mean, Bruce did a lot as well. Those were the two people that I kind of saw running around like mad trying to make things happen, Bruce and Jonathan. But because of Jonathan's presence, I guess there was a lot of kind of talk about accessibility and stuff, which I think is great. So check it out. If you're in that area, definitely make it next year to the Northeast Linux Fest. a couple of days ago, I stumbled across the fact that CDE, the Common Desktop Environment, I think is what it stands for, it was open sourced. The code was actually finally open sourced, and it has not been open sourced since, I don't know, 1998 or something. I mean, it's kind of like a lot of people who ran Unix back in the day and actually did use a GUI. The CDE desktop is kind of what they remember. That's the definitive desktop that existed. I'd never used it. I've used FVWM a little bit. I've used what's the other ugly one? TWM? I don't know. You know, I mean, I've seen things that kind of vaguely resemble CDE, but never had actually used it. Didn't really have a clear idea of what it was like, you know, like, what did it do? What was unique about it? I knew that it was supposed to be very ugly, and that was about all I knew. Well, read online that CDE had been open sourced, I think maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. I don't think it was 2 years. I think maybe a year ago it finally got all the code open sourced. So I thought that might be kind of fun to mess around with. So I went over to its SourceForge page and downloaded it. Turned out it depended upon Motif, libmotif. So I compiled that, installed Motif, and then compiled and installed CDE. And it's not a difficult install at all. It's a little bit wonky in that it has its own installer script. So it doesn't like to be cut into it, you know, broken out into a separate installer. It's got its installation method, and that's kind of how it's done. And it's nothing at all that would play nice with a package manager that you and I are used to. So I did a lot of slicing and dicing of its kind of around its install script and sort of forced it to install itself into a separate directory and then kind of parsed what that directory did through a Slack build. So in the end, I got a really nice reversible, you know, removable Slack build script that will install CDE and record all the location of the files, and that way you can remove it if you want to. So it's like a proper installer. And it does exist now, so if you go to slackermedia.info/slackbuilds, you'll see the libmotif Slack build that I did, which was that's pretty easy, fairly trivial. And then there's the CDE Slack build that you can try out if you are inclined to do that. There are a lot of weird hacks that you have to do even after the Slack build script runs. There's a couple of different locations on the system that it really wants access to that you might not have access enabled for it without actually going in and doing it, and the Slack build will not do that for you, so you have to do that. There's some kind of socket thing that needs to be running in order for CDE to launch correctly, so you have to kind of start that through the etc rc.drc scripts. So there are a couple of things that you have to do, and not all that is in the README. But the important thing and the cool thing is that it still works. It launches, it runs really just as you would expect a desktop to run. I mean, it's a complete desktop from, yeah, like 1998 or whenever it was, possibly earlier. And it's interesting to look back at it because it really does establish kind of its own identity. And I think one of the interesting things to look at when we're looking at user interfaces is where do the conventions that we all kind of know and love, where do these conventions come from? And I feel like so many of them, because most of us grew up on Windows or Mac, a lot of them are just kind of, we take them for granted because that's the way those two operating systems that we learned did those things. But on CDE, it really comes across that they were not, or at least as far as I can tell, they were totally not influenced by other operating systems. It really seems like they just had their own way of doing things. And it was kind of developed in a bubble almost. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but it certainly is how it feels. I mean, they've got completely a complete different way of doing things. I mean, they have the virtual desktops, which is amazing. I mean, back in, like I say, like the 90s or whenever it was, they've got virtual desktops way before anyone else even imagined such a thing. They've got weird, I mean, they don't have like a quit in their file menu. You have to just go up to the window decoration and you just close that window. There's no application window. There's this little dock and there are some corners that you click and you get some menus, and then you can kind of drag those docks out and they detach themselves and you can kind of make them floating menus. And anytime an application is open, you can click a little button and it minifies itself, if that's a word. It minimizes itself into an icon that sits on your desktop. So any icon on your desktop in CDE is not a location, it's not a file, it's not a folder, it is a running application that you have essentially minimized. So it's, I guess, like a task manager or a dock, whatever. Really, really interesting, quirky things that you notice, you know, you take notice of because, well, you don't know how to do anything yet, and you're clicking around trying to figure out, you know, I'm right-clicking, hoping that it will bring up a Fluxbox-style window launch menu. I'm hitting Alt-F2, hoping for a run command interface. Everything that I kind of expected was not there. So it was really, really interesting to see this very, I guess, singular kind of desktop environment, and to think that that was the original Unix desktop. That's the Unix desktop, presumably, without any influence from other graphical environments. And that's really cool. And I think it's, like, as cheesy as it is, it's important to kind of look back at that history and maybe take ownership, as it were, of some of those conventions and really be okay with having our own interface conventions, because I don't think that necessarily the best conventions are the same conventions that everyone else is using. I don't know that all of those things work for me. In fact, I know that some of them don't, because every time I get a computer and set it up, I've got a whole config file that I load onto it, you know, so that I can work around some of the default conventions, like you have to go up here and click this button and select this from a menu in order to do some task. I don't want to do that. I want it to be all keyboard shortcut down. So really, really interesting stuff. It's a lot of fun. It's horribly ugly. You should try it whenever you get a chance. So it's CDE. It's a Slack build. It exists. slackermedia.info/slackbuilds. It's not exactly what I would call a clean Slack build. I mean, it's not clean. It's just there's a lot of hacking that had to go on in order for it to work. So don't expect it to be pretty code. But it does install correctly. It will not live on your computer forever. You can remove PKG it fine. It works quite well. And there's extensive readmes and stuff, so if you do install it, you really do have to kind of read through that. Go to the CDE wiki, look at what you have to do in order to get it running on Linux, because there are a couple of weird things that you have to do in order for it to run. But it's very cool, it's a lot of fun, and of course there are pictures over on unixporn.com. You can check out a couple of screenshots that I made just to kind of give you an idea of what it looks like. Music means, it means it's time for a cup of coffee, so why don't you take a coffee break? I'll do the same, and we'll get back and finish this episode up. I've been playing around with different web servers lately, not necessarily by choice, or rather, not because I want to try different web servers. It's just because I've been kind of driven to different web servers for different reasons. So there are obviously Apache. There is Apache, of course, which I've used really just kind of as a basic user. I'm not a wizard when it comes to the Apache configuration stuff. I can do the basics, and that's kind of it. I don't feel badly about Apache, but at the same time, I do know that it's a big application. It has a lot of components to it. It's very extensible. It's a big project. And partly because I just know that I don't need that complexity. And the other part is because I know that my computer, you know, all the different computers that I do little web things on may not be able to actually handle Apache very well. For these reasons, I kind of avoid Apache in my real life, like for my own projects. I don't really use Apache. So one of the alternatives that I found via my friend DeepGeek from Hacker Public Radio and TalkGeek to me was THTTPD. THTTPD is, I think it's the tiny HTTPD, and it was serving us really well. It was fine. We were running actually GNU World Order on it for quite some time, and it was working. And then I decided to move Slacker Media over to it, and try as I might, I could not get UTF-8 encoding to register properly on THTTPD. Further investigation, well, the initial investigation revealed that it was just like some little one line in a configuration file, you switch that and restart and restart the server rather, and not the server, but the HTTPD server, restart that, and it's all good. And it didn't really work that way. So try as I might, I could not get UTF-8 to happen. And did a little bit more investigation, and it seemed like basically it was a known issue and it was not going to get fixed because THTTPD isn't really an active project as far as I can tell. And I mean, I'm not quoting from I can't cite references right now, but that's the general feel that I got about THTTPD. Having had that experience, I really have nothing bad to say about THTTPD other than if you want it for anything but flat files encoded in, I guess, what is it, ISO 9958 or whatever, then you may not want to try THTTPD. But in terms of its memory footprint and kind of its performance and everything, I mean, it's really nice. And it's got some really nice features like chrooting so that people on your web server are, as far as their computer knows, that's all that exists on that computer. So it's got some really nice and kind of cool security features. It doesn't do anything CGI. It doesn't do any kind of scripting or anything. It's I think it's HTML 1.1 is what it, or HTTP 1.1 rather, is what it's qualified to do. And it just really doesn't do too much else than that. It's really quite nice. There are the usual .htaccess files that you can leverage for a little bit of customization. And there's a pretty simplified configuration file that you can leverage for custom error pages and things like that. But mostly it's really, really simple. And I think we were running it on a server with 128 megabytes of RAM at one point. I mean, it was really, really low and it was doing fine. It was serving up, I don't know, four or five different sites and it just kept working. It worked. It did splendidly. We've recently started to move away from that because of the UTF-8 problem and a couple of other limitations. I don't really remember what. I think primarily it's UTF-8, but there might be a couple of other things that I found. So the one that I started looking at as opposed to THTTPD was Nginx, because I'd heard a lot of good things about Nginx. I know someone, well, Cobra2 runs Nginx a lot, so I kind of felt like if I needed support, I could probably get him to help me. So I decided to try Nginx, and that's, of course, as opposed to something like Lighty, L-L-H-T-T-P-D, I think, which I was totally willing to try as well. I just Nginx and Lighty were neck and neck, and since I know someone who runs Nginx, I figured that would be the smart way to go. So I did that. And it turns out that it's been really, really nice. It's been, in terms of memory footprint, it's been great. It has not caused me any issues whatsoever. And the configuration is super simple. I mean, really, if you're just running one site off of your box, it's a question of installing the Nginx server, starting it, and you're up and running. And it's as simple as that. I mean, the default configuration is probably all you need, as long as you've got your files in the right location. The default location, the default web root location is /var/www/htdocs. Put your files in there and you're good. You've got everything you need. So it's really, really nice. But of course, just one site was not what I needed. I need multiple sites. So how hard was it to set up a virtual host? Turns out, really easy. It's in the same configuration file. There's an example in the configuration file that you can use, and it's simply opening up a new server line, server, curly bracket, listen on 80, listen localhost, :80, server name is mynewcoolsite.com, alias mynewcoolersite.info, semicolon, location of the web root, and you can make that whatever you want, so it's /var/www/mynewcoolsite.com, and define the index page, and that's it. It's literally, what was that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, like 10 lines, and you've got another virtual host right there in Nginx. Very, very simple. It's quite neat. And it also gives you the benefit of having the option of going to, you know, of going ahead and doing things like PHP and other sort of CGI kinds of things, fast CGI, stuff like that, because that is built in. It does not have chrooting, so you don't get that functionality. Previous versions did, but apparently it might have been a different server, actually. I was going to say previous versions did have the chrooting available, but then it was decided that it wasn't really done right anyway, and they just decided not to bother, and they were kind of recommending just installing SE Linux or something similar, and just relying upon that to do a chroot-like monitoring of what people are doing on your server. So that's not really something that I'm using, obviously, since it doesn't have that feature. But other than that, I can't really think of anything to complain about on the thing. And it's performing really, really well on a Raspberry Pi with, what, 256 megabytes of RAM? So, and it's serving up, I think, something like three sites for me right now. So it's working out really well. The character set, by the way, is UTF-8 by, I think, default. And if it isn't, then you can just go into that same configuration file and change the char set to UTF-8, restart Nginx, and suddenly everything is UTF-8 by default. So quite nice, quite convenient, and it's just a breeze to use because it really is. I mean, the configuration file is just, it's really well commented. You got lots of examples for all the different setups that you could possibly imagine, and it works that way. Now, I was talking to someone, I think Evil James, in the Slacker Media channel, actually, and he was saying that Nginx didn't have the scalability that he needed. You know, you get, like, I don't know, 20,000 hits on it, and the server starts breaking. That's quite possible, and I made that number up, but whatever. As you know, dear listeners, I anticipate 30... maybe 35 maximum page hits, you know, every 2 weeks. So I'm not really too concerned about scalability. But in terms of needing a quick and easy web server to set up and not break your machine, I do highly recommend Nginx. I think it's a nice little server. Now, the other one I've also started playing around with is Hiawatha, H-I-A-W-A-T-H-A. Hiawatha is a similar to Lighty and Nginx. I mean, it's designed to be a lightweight, simplified web server. And I haven't played around with it all that much. I will say that it is very attractive. I mean, the pages that it generates, they are very attractive. So if you go to, for instance, slackermedia.info/slackbuilds and go to and look at the directory listing, which I have enabled in an htaccess file, you'll see that the fancy looking kind of default listing of all the directories and files in that directory. So it looks pretty nice. The one thing that kind of annoys me is the error page thing. I can't seem to get it to do its own error pages per virtual host, which I would like. It seems to generate error pages with a PHP script, but last I looked, I couldn't actually find where that PHP script lived on the system. And even then I would prefer not to have to do it in PHP. So a couple of little complaints, I guess, but not really. So far, it's been working out really nicely. Haven't got really any serious complaints about functionality. The configuration, again, is really, really simple. And I don't mean to make it out such that Apache configuration is all that difficult, but I don't know. In compared to Apache, I feel like the configuration of all of these that I've been talking about, Nginx, Hiawatha, and THTTPD, is a lot simpler. It's one file. It's really well commented. It's stuff that you can emulate really quickly and then copy and paste and just kind of change the host names and everything's sort of falls into place around it. All of them seem to be very lightweight, I mean, just as advertised in terms of memory usage and kind of process usage, although probably part of it is that all of my pages so far are complete flat HTML. So it's not really like they have to work that hard anyway. So if you're doing something aside from flat HTML, your mileage may vary. But I've been really happy with them, and I've tried running them so far on, I think the lowest powered thing is actually a Pentium 4, I want to say a 1.6 gigahertz machine with 256 megabytes of RAM. That might be the lowest powered. It feels pretty low powered. I don't know. I could be being generous, but the Raspberry Pi also, that's pretty low powered. And that has been, like I say, it's been serving up about three different sites for me. Not a whole lot of traffic in flat HTML, but it's been working out just fine. Haven't had a problem with it. So check some of those out if you want to. I think right now I feel most comfortable with Nginx, but feel free to try any of the other ones out and let me know what you think. I think that's about it for this episode. So feel free to send me feedback at all the usual email addresses. And thanks for listening. And I will talk to you probably in about a week. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as NotClaTo. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Who are you?